Thank you very much for having me here today. I am supposed to be talking to you about an advocate's point of view and what it's like to do a campaign for a smoke-free workplace law from the grassroots perspective. First, before I start, though, I want to recognize someone in the audience who was on the Smoke-Free DC Steering Committee, who did a huge amount of work and was absolutely wonderful and also instrumental in getting this law passed. Jim Bogdan, can you please stand up? This is hugely, hugely helpful. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just briefly tell you how we got started, and then I'm going to go through some lessons that we learned that I think could be helpful to any of you who are doing similar campaigns, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about how the implementation has gone. But first, I want to say something about the nature of Washington, D.C., because someone said, wow, you're in the nation's capital, and, you know, all eyes are upon you, that kind of thing. You know, we really didn't feel like that so much. It was very much a local battle. The D.C. Council is pretty locally focused. You know, they're caring about the potholes and the fire hydrants that don't work and crime in neighborhoods, and, you know, they're focusing on that. And, you know, in the very beginning, we said, well, don't you want to set the example for the rest of the country? And at that time, they really didn't care so much, and that didn't work so well. However, there are a couple things about D.C. that made it very helpful and helped our campaign. The first is that this place attracts a lot of type A personalities who want to do something and are here to make a difference in whatever jobs they're at. So it's actually pretty easy to get them involved in something they care about or are interested in. And the second thing that is helpful is it's also a rather transitory city. And as we were working on this, and as more and more states and cities went smoke-free, more people started moving here from those places, from Boston and New York and California, and they would come up to us and say, well, you know, I went into this restaurant and I couldn't believe that they asked me if I wanted smoking or non-smoking. I can't believe you guys aren't smoke-free. What can I do to help? So that was very helpful about being here. Just briefly, this whole movement started in 2002. I just went to one restaurant too many when I was waiting for a table and someone lit up next to me in the bar area, and New York City had just gone smoke-free, and Florida, my home state, had voted by an astounding 71% for smoke-free restaurants, and I thought, you know, we should be able to do that here. And if someone's doing something, I want to help, and if they're not, I'd like to kind of start something. So I got on the internet, and I found a website put up by Michael Takalowski, who many of you know, a very passionate activist, and he had put together a list of restaurants in the district that were smoke-free. It was a pretty small list. So I called him, and I said, well, what are you doing? And he said, well, I have this idea for a petition and a restaurant, a window sticker, and I said, well, great, you know, let's get started. Let's do something, and that's kind of how the whole thing started. A few lessons. The formula really works. The formula of education, 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 and then legislation, it really does work. You know, we worked for years going out to fairs and festivals and basically any event we could to explain the hazards of secondhand smoke. And, you know, when I first started doing this, people would be surprised to hear that California and New York City were smoke-free. And then by the end, people were coming up to me saying, well, you know, Boston went smoke-free, and their business is doing just fine. And well, I said, oh, thank you for telling me. I appreciate that. So that was really good. Another thing that was hugely helpful is it was all the studies that many of your organizations put out. You know, studies about health effects of secondhand smoke and studies about economic data. It really enabled us to create a drumbeat. We basically, every time a new study would come out, would send an email to all the council members and say, hey, just wanted to remind you, look at this, look at that. You know, it's now, you know, there's proof that it causes this kind of cardiovascular problem. And so it really enabled us to keep a drumbeat going. Another thing that was hugely helpful is polling data. And early on, the Cancer Society very kindly commissioned a poll that, despite the fact we really hadn't done much education, it was early on, showed very high rates of people who would go out more frequently if the city was smoke-free and had smoke-free restaurants and bars. And we used that data throughout the campaign to remind council members and remind a lot of other people that this is would be an extremely popular measure if they were to pass it. The component that you definitely need is the grassroots, and you really need citizens to be doing it, not to knock paid organizers, but citizens can really help mobilize citizens. And, you know, if you have enough passionate volunteers, they're really going to go out and work the streets. I mean, we did so many things, events that proved to be really helpful. We went to basically every fair and festival we could, whether it was health-related or not. One day, we even went to the opening of a metro station. And you might say, well, what does that have to do with smoke-free? But we really wanted to get to the mayor and a couple of the politicians, and we knew they were going to show up. So TAC came up with what I thought was at first a nutty idea, and turned out to be a very brilliant idea, to show up beforehand with our stickers. And let me just show you here. This is actually a restaurant window sticker we put together. This was the sticker that we distributed thousands of over the years. So we showed up before this metro station opening and distributed these stickers, and everyone was, you know, supportive. So the mayor rolls up along with a couple of the council members, and he looks out, and everyone's wearing this "I Love a Smoke-Free DC" sticker, even though it had nothing to do with the event. It was very effective, and it actually helped a lot. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that the grassroots activists can do, and we can be pretty agile. We weren't bureaucratic, you know. We would just decide via email that we were going to do something, and we could go do it. And we could say things about some of the politicians that some of the larger public health organizations didn't feel comfortable saying. And that's, you know, so there's definitely a role for grassroots. Another lesson is that you really don't need a whole lot of money. In fact, we just didn't have a lot of money. We have very talented people on our steering committee, but none of us were good at raising money. I'm terrible at it. I hate asking people for money. And we just got donations here and there. And really, all we needed was money for stickers like this, money for our T-shirts, and money to pay entry fees for fairs and festivals. And that was pretty much it. So you really can do an awful lot with very little. At any given time, we had maybe, you know, a few thousand dollars in the bank. Another lesson that we found helpful was to go on the offense and not always be on the defense. A number of times, the Restaurant Association early on kind of went on the attack, and we were constantly kind of playing defense, and we thought, well, what can we do about this? So we started thinking about the Restaurant Association and looking at their website, and we looked at their membership, and we realized, you know, they have members in D.C., but also Virginia and Maryland. So we thought, well, it doesn't look like there are that many, really, in D.C. So we called the city, and we got a list of all the licensed restaurants in the district, and then we compared it to the number of D.C. restaurants that were members of the association, and we found that the Restaurant Association really just had 12% of the restaurants in the district, and that was very helpful, because then we could go to the council and say, you know, when the Restaurant Association comes to you and tells you they're representing all restaurants, they're really not. It's just 12%. And that's something that you guys probably can do wherever you are, and that's a really valuable statistic. Because here, the Restaurant Association really was kind of our main competitor. They were very entrenched. The lobbyist was a really good friend of many of the council members, the association had donated a lot of money to the council, and so they were really entrenched, and it took a lot of the grassroots work to overcome that the influence of the association. But that's one thing that you can do. We also did something that was kind of fun. I think Jim was doing this, checked their website pretty regularly, and we saw, you know, every year they have their Restaurant Association Awards, you know, best chef, best this, best that. And they take sponsorships for this. So they very proudly put on their website that Altria was a platinum sponsor for like something like $50,000. So perfect, wonderful. So we made up these flyers saying, who does the Restaurant Association really represent? And they're taking money from the tobacco industry. And their awards were on a Sunday here, and Jim and I and Tack came out, and we kind of did a little mini picket thing, and we as members of the Restaurant Association came in, we were handing out these flyers, and we also, of course, sent them out to the council members and reporters to say, look, you know, look how much money they're taking from the tobacco industry. So that was kind of fun and I think rather effective. We also made the smoke-free issue, we tried to make it an election issue. And we did a nice little voter guide this is a bit of a small thing, but you can see these little symbols. They're a bit blurry here. And, you know, we put every candidate down and put their position and put a little cigarette or a no smoking sign or question mark by their names. And we handed out thousands of these at one particular festival. And it was helpful with one particular council member. We were at Adams Morgan Day, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a huge event here, a huge neighborhood festival. It was right before the primaries. It was great. And at that point, Jim Graham hadn't come out with a position yet on this. He was still on the fence. And his support was really critical because Adams Morgan is a huge bar area, and we really needed his support. So during the festival, thousands of people were coming up to us, and we were giving out stickers, and they said, "What can we do to help? We've already signed the petition." We said, "Well, here's the scorecard. Please go and vote in the election next week. And by the way, Jim Graham's booth is just down there. And if you want to go and talk to him, please do." And all day long, people were just going down to his booth. And, you know, he's really an approachable guy. And so finally in the afternoon, he comes up. He says, "Okay, I get the message. You're sending all these people my way." And it turns out he eventually did come out for us, which was hugely helpful. But this definitely helped. And then another thing that I do, and this was a bumper sticker that became another when I'm talking about the materials. And another thing I just want to touch on, and I know that this can be a delicate issue, and in every area of the country, it seems like there's issues with, you know, cooperation between the grassroots organizations and the public health organizations, and I know that there can be friction. And I just want to say, there's room for everyone. Everyone has a role in this, and the public health organizations are tremendously, I mean, you have so much credibility when you speak about health issues because you represent the health community. And, you know, I think there's room for everybody to do, you know, enough, and there's enough work to go around, and grassroots people can really be effective in what they do. And I just think, you know, just hearing some of the tales from around the country that they're just, it would be really helpful for the whole effort if there was more coordination, you know, between the grassroots groups and the public health groups. My last lesson is really never give up. It will happen eventually. You know, when we started, I know it sounds hard to believe, one of the council members, in fact, a council member who was the head of the health committee, was a smoker who smoked in her office in City Hall. I'm not making this up. We went in her office one day, and we were like, "Oh my God, we're selling cigarette smoke." So not only, I mean, that's pretty bad, but you could tell at that point how bad the law was, that it was legal for her to do that in City Hall. You know, we also had, you know, a mayor who at the time, the former mayor, was very much against us, and early on there was this photo spread in the Washington Post of, you know, just kind of a featurey thing about what the council members and the elected officials do on their off time, and there was, you know, one person with their cat and another person in the garden, and the former mayor was photographed kind of in his, you know, trademark bow tie and tux, leaning back in some club with this huge cigar sticking out of his mouth. You know, that's what we were starting with, and we, you know, our legislation initially went to a committee run by a libertarian ex-smoker who told us she would never let it see the light of day. You know, that's what we started at, but now here we are smoke-free. So, you know, it can happen, and just keep plugging away at it because it really can. As far as implementation goes, I really don't have a whole lot to say about it because it's been going really smoothly. We were concerned because the law that got passed was not as strong as we had wanted. We wanted no exemptions. We wanted just a complete, you know, sealed law. There are a few exemptions for, say, tobacco bars. There is something that we were really worried about, an economic hardship waiver. And we really thought, you know, that has such potential to be abused. But the way the regulations are written, it's pretty hard to get one. Only one has been granted, and that's been fairly recent. And only a handful of exemptions have been granted, we're very fortunate. And the Department of Health has been quite responsive. We have something on our website where people can, you know, send complaints to us, and we forward them to the Department of Health, and they're very responsive. They have a night inspector who goes out to follow up on complaints and talk to restaurant managers, and you know, they've issued warning letters. They've really followed up pretty well. So implementation so far is going great. people are really happy with the law. We get a lot of people who, you know, are still saying thank you, which is really nice. In fact, you know, if you go down tonight to, you know, just down the street to Chinatown, you'll probably have a hard time getting in one of the restaurants because, you know, they're pretty packed. So it has been good for business, and it has been good for health, too, which, of course, was the overall intent. And I'm just happy that we're all smoke-free here. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Angela. Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, the first major national organization to adopt a policy that all of its meetings be held in smoke-free locations was the American Public Health Association back in 2004, which we're all excited about. And so this afternoon, Alan Baker, who's the chief of staff here for APHA, is going to talk with us briefly about the association policy and how that's gone for them. And we appreciate you taking time away from the Governing Council to be with us.
I'm happy to take time away from the Governing Council.
I know. Anybody who's sat in that meeting will know I'm glad
to hear. I love the Governing Council. But I'm happy to be here because this is an important issue. And we are proud of being the first national organization. So let me tell you what sort of happened, what we sort of did, and sort of what the rest of the story is, because it's never quite just as simple as it seems. This is actually a particular pleasure for me, because when I was I was at the Maryland Department of Health for about 25 years, and for seven of those years I oversaw some public health programs, including our tobacco control efforts. And I was also the health officer in Charles County, Maryland for a while. That's a historical tobacco growing county. And so I was appointed as the acting health officer after the previous health officer had been fired by the commissioners. And so not long in my tenure there, I got to go to the county fair. The county fair is a big deal. The health department has a booth. We have a display. And like a lot of agricultural counties, they have a farm queen, except in Charles County, Maryland, it's Miss Nicotine because of the tobacco growing tradition. So I was pretty sure at health officer, I wasn't going to be the first battle I fought. And actually, the county government was pretty progressive. They actually had made county office buildings, and they owned the building that the health department was in smoke-free, but the county fair still had Miss Nicotine, and actually made still today. But so you do have to sort of pick your battles. I somehow thought Miss Nicotine didn't probably hurt the public health as much as actually smoking in public buildings, so I thought we were getting there. So as Bob said, we did pass a 2004 annual meeting that we would have a resolution. And the Governing Council passed that. It was not a policy statement. As you know, we have this huge database of about 1,000 or more policies. It was not a policy. It had come up through the policy process, that year-long iterative process that the Governing Council is in and passing, literally passing policies right as we speak. But rather, it was a resolution that came up at the very end of the meeting as new business. And so that's something that directs staff to do something, but it's a little different than policies, and it's actually not quite as public because it's not in that policy database that people can go in and search on by word and things like that. And so just like we have done today, we had already written a press release anticipating which policies would pass through the policy process, and then, of course, we tweak it because of the actual votes. And so quickly, at the end of the day, since this came up as one of the last orders of business, we amended it. At the very end of our press release, which was about 4 pages talking about the 20 policies we passed that year, we added a new catch-all sentence that said, the Governing Council also passed a procedural measure in support of smoke-free cities. Under the measure, all future APHA annual meetings beyond those already contracted by the associations will be held in smoke-free cities unless an exception is made by the executive. Full language of the measure is available here, and there was a link. Now, if you actually clicked on the link, you found out the policy, the resolution itself was actually shorter than those 2 sentences, because the resolution really just said that APHA will hold its future meetings in smoke-free cities with the understanding that APHA has contracts until 2011. And 2011 is a very interesting point here, and I'll come back to that. So we initially released a press release, both to gather some, to give ourselves credit, but and also because, you know, to get this reported in our hometown, the Washington Post, but also to put it out there nationally that we were doing this and hopefully other associations and other folks would jump on board too. And but the fact that we are located in D.C., and this is our home office, was ideal in a couple ways because Dr. also been the health commissioner in D.C. So that gave him a special, perhaps, vantage point to comment from. And he knew a lot of the county council folks, though he had worked for a previous mayor then who was in office then. And so we, of course, immediately wrote to the mayor and said, you know, this is really great. This is really important. We're sort of tentatively scheduled to come to D.C. in 2011, and we'd really like to do it, but D.C. really has to sort of go smoke-free. Now, there was some discussion of whether we had actually gone so far in the contracting process for 2011, and certainly the resolution that passed was done in such a way that we didn't technically have to implement it to 2012, but we saw we had a rare leverage point because we hadn't signed the final contract. So at this point, we had given up all our hold to all other cities and had no other place to go. So,
but they didn't know that.
We told the truth, but we left some stuff out. We forgot. And the other thing we did, we wrote to the Convention Center Authority because we had signed a contract. We were one of the first large national organizations to ever sign a contract for this building. So we had signed a contract, a package deal, in 2004 and 2007 because we have another resolution that says we come back to D.C. about every 3 years because folks love it here. And so we had gotten a great rate. So we knew we were coming back in 2007. And we were pretty sure we were coming back in 2011 because you got to come back every 3 years or so. But, you know, we felt we had some leverage because we hadn't signed the contracts. And so we point out that we are estimated that we bring $15 million to a city when we come. A little bit of that, you know, much of that is in registration, but of course not nearly $15 million. That's probably more like $2.5 million. And some of it's the exhibitors, but you all stay in hotels, you all eat, you all ride cabs. It's a lot of, you know, we're at 13,000 people as of yesterday, last night, and that's a lot of business. And so we thought that perhaps that economic argument is often what helps sell. We've all made economic arguments to sell other public health policies. And so we thought that not only would we write to the mayor, we would try to get the convention center folks listening. And, you know, that catches their attention real fast. And since we hadn't signed the contract, we thought we had a little leverage. And then and we had actually been on record supporting previous smoke-free bills. I'm sure that it's been mentioned this was not the first smoke-free bill in the city. This was the first smoke-free bill in the city that passed. And the timing was actually pretty good because the bill came up again not long after our meeting in November. And so our resolution was still really fresh, and fresh helps you get publicity and helps get people's attention. So when it came up again, you know, we wrote to every member of the county council. We wrote to the mayor, Dr. Benjamin, because he knew them, was able to put personal notes on some of them. And of course, we, you know, partnered and worked with, you know, the local smoke-free groups and so forth. And so, you know, it was really, it was a tremendous opportunity for us to actually, because many of us are ex-public health practitioners who now sort of work in an association setting. So it was a great opportunity for us to be both a national leader and to locally practice our